And it is 72 degrees this morning in Kenosha, 71 right now in Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. It is 10 past 8. The morning show with Greg Berg is next. Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, where students can conduct NASA research, produce an original play, or join an in-house marketing agency as early as their freshman year. More information is available at carthage.edu. And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. This is the monthly program that features Nan Calvert, who always does such a good job of rounding up interesting guests for us to speak to, guests who have something to do with the environment and, in many cases, work in restoring the environment. And as a matter of fact, that is exactly what we are talking about today in a really interesting way. We're going to be finding out about the work of a group called Resource Environmental Solutions, and we are speaking with Deanna Nicky, who is with RES as a restoration ecologist, and that intriguing term, which I honestly have not heard of until this opportunity, speaks volumes about the work of Resource Environmental Solutions. And so Deanna is going to be telling us a bit more about this whole notion of what restoration ecology is and what a restoration ecologist does and the kind of exciting projects that they have been engaged in, not just here in Wisconsin, but actually across the country. Deanna Nicky, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for answering Nan's invitation to be part of the morning show. Before we learn a bit about Resource Environment Solutions, let's find out a little bit about you, where you come from originally, and at what point in your life you began to have an interest in the environment.
Well, I grew up in Pewaukee, Wisconsin, and honestly, I'd say as young as I can remember, I had an interest in all things natural. Spent much of my younger years out in the woods and in the garden and camping, and really just always had a love for our natural world. So, and it just grew over time. So
I'm assuming you went to school to study this. Tell us where you pursued your studies and exactly what kind of academic track you followed.
I went for field biology and ecology at UW-Whitewater. I minored in geology and environmental studies. Did a lot of botany-related courses and, just general ecology courses, but really focused on plants. It has always been my passion. So
interesting. So from college and even during college, as you were pursuing these studies, did you have particular goals in mind in terms of what your ultimate destiny was, your calling in terms of working with the environment?
I did not. I really never envisioned that this was necessarily what I was going to be doing. But when I fell into a position with another company, I fell in love with it instantly. It's such a rewarding field. You can literally see the progress you've made in an hour, in a day, in a week, and then, obviously into the long term to see the big picture of what the work we're doing is bringing about. So,
and that's an important point to make, because of course there's all kinds of laudable work that does not necessarily have that kind of visceral payoff in terms of being able right. to look and see the difference that you are making. So you are a restoration ecologist with RES, and in a moment we'll find out what a restoration ecologist is and does. But first, tell us about Resource Environment Solutions.
Well, RES Great Lakes, which is the division of the company that I'm with, we were previously Applied Ecological Services and just became a part of RES. It's a nationwide company that does everything from small scale restorations and maintenance to large scale dam removals and river restorations. So kind of everything. There's a lot going on with solar farms these days and installing prairie along amongst the solar panels. So really just kind of, you know, everything you could imagine ecologically, as far as ecological restoration goes, the company partakes in. So
you step into the picture when damage has been done to the environment.
Yeah. Or, you know, if there's just an area that's just needing a little help as far as invasive species removal and things like that. You know, really our job is, you know, kind of undoing damage of one sort or another, whether it is the introduction of invasive species or land disturbance in general, from, you know, agricultural practices, residential and commercial development, things of that nature. So yeah, we step in and kind of assist the recovery of ecosystems that have been degraded or damaged or destroyed, and undo historic and present abuses to these habitats. So.
Right. So, but that's interesting to me that, so in other words, sometimes we're talking about a given environment, a landscape that has suffered harm, but not necessarily inflicted by human beings. Although I suppose, I'm guessing most of the time we're talking about that kind of damage, but sometimes damage can occur for, let's say, more natural reasons. I mean, is that fair to say that you also deal with those situations?
I'd say it's more often than not human related. I mean, whether it's intentional or not, you know, a lot of invasive species that we have were unintentionally brought into the environment. You know, typically when you have a situation like fire, that's typically a good thing for our native landscapes. I mean, we do prescribe burning for that very reason. It helps along native landscapes. So, you know, and flooding and things of that nature, you know, we do a lot with floodplain restoration, streams and wetland restorations, as we're seeing, you know, these heavier rainfalls and these bigger storm events occurring, things like that. The natural environment just needs a little support every once in a while to kind of keep up. So.
And you are specifically a restoration ecologist, and how would you characterize what it is that you do on a daily basis?
Well, I personally am a project manager, a restoration project manager, and we do ecological restoration. So my role is, you know, finding us jobs, making sure that the jobs are getting done, you know, taking care of all the kind of business end of things. I'm not out in the field as often as I'd like to be anymore, but the people that are really out there, you know, making the magic happen are the crew members that are out there doing the work and, you know, providing the blood, sweat, and tears, sometimes literally, to get things moving. So
very good. We're speaking with Deanna Nicky, who is a restoration ecologist, project manager with Resource Environmental Solutions, the Great Lakes branch of the RES. Before we explore some of the very specific things that you and your colleagues have done, could you give us some sense of kind of the scope of what RES does across the country? I believe RES is headquartered down in Texas. I am assuming that you have an outreach that, does it span all 50 states or at least the 48 continental states? And what is sort of the scope of your presence and the work that you do?
I mean, there's a presence in most states. Applied Ecological was more in the Midwest. But like I said, RES does everything from invasive species removal, prescribed burning, stream and wetland restorations, erosion control, dam removals, reforesting areas, planting prairies, and introducing native species.
So what sets a given project in motion? I suspect that you don't just get to decide, oh, there's some damage here, we need to come in and fix it. Typically, what is the mechanism by which you are brought into a given setting and allowed to do your restoration work?
So typically, different municipalities and entities, Root Pipe Watershed Initiative would be one example. They will put out, a request for a proposal or a request for a bid on a job for, different habitat restorations, and we either bid on them or write a proposal to try to get onto the restoration project. And then once a project's awarded, then the work begins. So
the blood, sweat, and tears that you were talking about before.
That is correct.
So it's probably really important for us to understand one of the central tenets of what RES does. I think the turn of phrase on the front page of your website, which I liked a lot, is that you are in the business of doubling down on nature's own processes.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if you could take us inside that intriguing turn of phrase.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of, we hope to return, the natural functions of the land, kind of pre-settlement, there were processes that were allowed to take place that, humans aren't necessarily comfortable with all the time. Prescribed burning is a very good example of that. Back before settlement, a lightning strike might cause a prairie to burn, and it was just let to burn. And that's, just a natural process that occurs. Grazing used to occur across the land, and we have grazing to some extent, but it's much less so now than it was, pre-settlement times. It's kind of tending to nature as nature tends to us. It's kind of part of that, give and take that any relationship requires, and humans and the natural environment need to have that, that reciprocal relationship to survive together. So,
right. Related to that, the website talks about how you like to utilize nature-based strategies, which I think probably most of us can kind of glean what that means. But in the same sentence, it says we use green infrastructure. Can you explain that term, green infrastructure, and maybe give at least one sort of concrete example of how green infrastructure figures in the work you do?
Okay. Green infrastructure is kind of a newer, area that is being used a lot these days, especially by the different municipalities. you see it a lot for the use of, you know, flood control, like runoff control and in turn flood control. A lot of things like permeable pavers, you know, where most, you know, our concretes and our blacktop is impermeable and it all runs off and has to go somewhere. In this case, there's a lot of use of permeable pavers to help filter that water down. A lot of stormwater basins being used to kind of capture and filter the water before it ends up back into our groundwater. You know, the native plants are really great at filtering out pollutants and excess nutrients, and their root systems help to slow that water down, so we end up with less flooding and things of that nature. You know, there's green roofs, which I've not had any experience with, but it's a really great concept. Another way of, you know, kind of capturing and using water as to slow it down. So yeah, green infrastructures, there's, you know, a wide array of uses. And my shop specifically, we've done a lot with MMSD, Milwaukee Metro Sewer District, and, you know, they do a lot with stormwater basins and, you know, like I said, like the just kind of helping, you know, with floodplain management, things of that nature. It's all kind of interconnected for the health of, you know, our soil, our water, our air. So,
right. So it's a greener way of accomplishing something that maybe more traditionally has been accomplished in other ways.
Yeah. And it's a more sustainable way of doing so. You know, they're ripping out the concrete liners that used to line a lot of the creeks and such in the Milwaukee area, especially finding that just wasn't a sustainable means of water capture. So yeah, it's definitely a greener, more sustainable way of dealing with some of the issues that we see all too frequently with, you know, flooding specifically. But many issues can be dealt with and with green infrastructure. So
right, when the choice is made to utilize green infrastructure as being a more sustainable and ultimately better solution, does it sometimes mean making a concession, particularly in the short term, that a green infrastructure might have maybe less positive results in the short term, but makes sense in terms of the longer term, the longer view, that it is ultimately a better solution, even if in the short term, in terms of tangible results, it might not yield the same results? I'm not sure if I'm making my question very clear.
No, you are. I've not really experienced any, you know, negative short-term results from green infrastructure. I mean, the only, I guess, negative that I have ever experienced is that, you know, when you install native plants, some initially it's not that instant gratification that some people are looking for when you go to the landscape store and you buy, you know, your potted plants, and, you know, seed takes time and, you know, plants take time. And so really the only, you know, some people, it might not be aesthetically pleasing to some people, but I've not experienced any, you know, short-term issues with green infrastructure that, you know, would be cause for concern, I guess. So
right, I guess what the what prompted the question was kind of the notion that, you know, for instance, there's something that needs to be killed. I mean, one way to kill it that would be really fast and really effective would be pouring some horrible chemical on it. But, you know, you've killed the thing, and there you go. And there might be some other way to do it that is much more environmentally sensitive and also a more sustainable practice. Mm-hmm. But it's not going to kill it as quickly or as convincingly, in a sense. But
yeah.
But that doesn't make it the poorer choice. It's just one has to kind of understand that ramification of the choice.
Yeah. Unfortunately, we do have to use herbicide management with especially some of the native, or I'm sorry, some of the invasives that we have these days are pretty nasty and aren't controlled the best through like mechanical means, such as, you know, pulling or mowing. So we do have to use herbicide management. You know, we try to use it as little as we can, but again, there's a lot of invasives out there, and it becomes quite difficult to not use herbicides. So that is unfortunately part of it. You know, we're very careful about what we use, whether it's safe, things like that. But it is one of the parts of the job that be nice if we could do without, but unfortunately, you know, we have to control some plants that can't be controlled otherwise. So
fair enough. We're speaking with Deanna Nicky, who is a restoration ecologist, project manager with RES, their Great Lakes division. RES, Resource Environmental Solutions, is the nation's largest ecological restoration company. Deanna is with us on the morning show at the invitation of Nan Calvert. So Deanna Nicky, for instance, at the moment, can you share with us what projects your office is currently engaged in, and not just in this corner of the state, but throughout the state of Wisconsin, because I assume your activities range far and wide.
Well, my office specifically is out of Milwaukee, and in Wisconsin, we also have a Janesville office and an Appleton office. My office is working on a wide range of things. We do a lot of work with MMSD, like I said, you know, their water course maintenance. We do work on a few basins for MMSD. We do things for, you know, South Milwaukee School District. They have a really beautiful prairie and wetland around their property. We're doing the work for the Root Pike Watershed Initiative at UW Parkside with the Rusty Patch Bumblebee project. We do work at Shiawake Prairie. We're doing a big restoration at Shiawake West down in Pleasant Prairie. Of a big wetland mitigation site out in Sussex. It's about 150 acres. And, you know, we do work for the city of Greenfield, for Oak Creek. It's kind of all over the place. We do some work with We Energies in their natural areas. So yeah, we're very, a good variety of jobs.
Are some of these projects that in a sense go on into in perpetuity, or more typically, is a given project something where there is a finish line that you are anxious to cross, where the work is done and you can pack up your things and be on your way, or does that not happen very often when we are talking about this kind of restoration work?
It unfortunately does happen where we, you know, part ways with the land that we've been working on. You know, some projects go for a year, some projects are 5 years, 10 years. And when they get to that 5-year point, usually they're in pretty good shape where they're, you know, self-sustaining to some extent, but it is nice to always, you know, be able to keep eyes on a site so that, you know, if there is an issue, you can tackle it right away and it doesn't become a larger issue. So yeah, it all depends on the sites and the contracts that we get. But I'd say there's, you know, that finish line is bittersweet typically. You know, a lot of people really enjoy having a connection with the land, which takes time to build, and you know they prefer to work on a project for, you know, several years and onward, just to, you know, keep an eye on all that hard work you put in, and just, you know, they're like your babies, these projects are, you know, they're kind of, it's they bring you great pride when you can see something go from, you know, an old agricultural field to a thriving wetland ecosystem, or, you know, something like whatever the project might be. So
we're happy to have Nan Calvert join us. She had a little bit of technical issue in terms of joining our wonderful world of Zoom, but is with us now. Nan Calvert, we welcome you. Whoop. And you are muted, Nan.
Oh, there. Sorry. I couldn't connect. I'm so sorry.
That's all right. We've been talking mostly in generalities thus far with Deanna Nicky, again, restoration ecologist with Resource Environmental Solutions, but we're just about to dig into some specifics, and I'm happy that you're here, Nan, to help guide this portion of the conversation. Deanna Nicky, you mentioned the Rusty Patch Bumblebee Project at on the grounds of the University of Wisconsin Parkside, which has been talked about a couple of times on this program. But give us your perspective on exactly what you and your colleagues have been doing with that. I mean, is that a project that you are entirely overseeing or responsible for? Are you responsible for a certain aspect of it? What exactly has RES been doing with that project?
That's something, you know, it's a partnership between the Root Pike Watershed Initiative, UW Parkside, and then RES. And RES is doing the restoration work. So I'm overseeing that project. So far what we've done out there is removed, you know, invasive brush, which has already made a significant difference in just allowing, you know, there's less competition. So we're seeing a lot of native plants germinating and starting to do quite well out there just from removing some of the invasives. So last winter we removed woody invasives. We've been working on the herbaceous invasives during the growing season. And we'll be doing a prescribed burn out there this fall, and then overseeding afterwards. So, you know, next year things will really start to take off as far as the natives go, but it's coming along quite nicely just from the removal of invasives thus far. It's making a comeback. So
when did this work begin?
We started fall of last year on phase one. And we have phase one and phase two right now. I know three and four are going to be coming out soon. We're anxiously awaiting to see, but yeah, it's a super cool project. It's definitely something that when that came across my radar, I wanted that project. It's the kind of work that, you know, when you go to school for ecology or biology, or if you just have an interest in the natural world, it's the kind of things you want to be doing. When you can do work that not only has that instant gratification of, you know, look what I did in an hour, in a week, and, you know, in a month, but you can look forward to what the future brings for a site like that. And we've already had a rusty patch spotted on site. So, I mean, it doesn't always take a lot to bring about big change. And that's, I think, important, you know, just for everyone to realize that they can have a hand in this kind of symbiotic relationship we have with our environment, like we were talking about before. Like, it's something anyone can get involved in, and these little changes can make a big difference, and that's really important aspect. So
Nan Calvert, can you give us a little historical backdrop in terms of this project and the way in which RES was brought in and the nature of its collaboration with Root Pike Wind?
Well, the question about RES is a very easy one to answer. RES used to be called Applied Ecological Services, and we've used RES when it was Applied Ecological Services on a number of our projects. Of course, we bid out all of the projects whenever we have one come across the desk, as it were. But their, you know, their description, their plan was really something that seemed to work the best for us and for UW Parkside. So in actuality, even though work started on phase one last fall and winter, the project got going a few years back. So it takes a long time to bring a project to fruition. Part of the problem was that on the UW Parkside cross country course, there were a number of places where stormwater runoff, which is also called sheet flow, wasn't flowing. So a lot of it would become inundated with water. And for those of you who are not aware, UW Parkside has sort of an internationally renowned cross country course. And so it was becoming problematic. And so because Root Pipe Watershed Initiative Network is all about water and stormwater runoff and water quality, we entered into a conversation with UW Parkside. We, you know, had a lot of fact finding done, and then had a plan developed. And then by last fall, we were ready to get things going. But all along, you know, for 2 or 3 years on average, probably more than that for every project, you know, you bring the main players together, you talk a lot, you discuss what everyone's goals and hopes and dreams are. You talk about the potential benefits, you look for funding. So there's a lot of work that the general public doesn't see that happens before somebody like RES and Deanna actually hit the ground running. So it's been a success for a while because it is an enormous project and there's a lot of key players. And then to suddenly have the confirmed sighting of a rusty patched bumblebee without even reseeding an area, because as Deanna said, once the invasive woody species and other things were knocked down, the things that were suppressed, the seed bank and the plants that were suppressed in the soil by these invasive species, you know, they were free to start to bloom again. And it's sort of like, you know, if the native plants are growing and the right ones are growing, they will come. And so that was our first confirmed sighting of a rusty patch bumblebee. So I think we're all still on cloud nine because of that. So not only did we want to take care of the stormwater runoff difficulties that were happening along the course and improve water quality, we also wanted to be part of bringing an endangered species back, and that species is the rusty patch bumblebee, who's a very important pollinator and used to be really quite common in this area. But because of habitat destruction, habitat loss, and other things, you know, it's really quite rare now. But we've made a few bees pretty happy as a result of embarking on this project. And it's not just the rusty patch that we support, it's all of our native pollinators. And in turn, all of our native bird and mammal and insect species, amphibians, reptiles, with native landscapes, because that's what they need. They're hardwired to recognize it and go for it. So, yeah, it's pretty darn exciting, I have to tell you.
With good reason.
I mean, I never thought in my life, actually, that I, you know, that I would get to see something like this happen. It's really quite fulfilling and amazing to be part of this.
I'm sure, because as Deanna and I were talking earlier, sometimes you do things and you are doing it more for the generation that comes after. I mean, that they are more likely to see tangible results than we might be, and it has to be thrilling is the word to see these kind
of results. Thrilling.
So Deanna, Nikki, so RES has mostly been about the business of removing the invasive species from this plot of land on the UW Parkside campus. So how has that been done? And has it been done in any kind of, I mean, how do you do that versus some well-meaning amateur citizen just with a bagging or whatever. I mean, what are the means that are at your disposal?
Well, we have, you know, larger equipment, I guess, than, you know, the general public. But, you know, we used a Fecon mower for some of the woody removal this past winter, but also a lot of brush saws and labor as far as dragging and burning those piles. You know, we do a lot of seed head collection, especially at Parkside. We don't want, if there is herbicide that needs to be applied and a plant is flowering, we remove the flowers beforehand so that we lessen the chances of a pollinator coming into contact with that herbicide. But really, we're using hand mowers, which is essentially like a weed whacker, a little bit higher powered weed whacker, but still bags, pruners, you know, backpack sprayers. So not too different from what, you know, citizens can be using in their own yards, with the exception of the Fecon mower maybe. But yeah,
so there's no magic spell. it's the same kind of hard work, but maybe done on a wider scale, maybe with a bit more sophistication in terms of, mm-hmm. of the equipment. When you're doing this kind of removal, is it much of an issue in terms of there being a few hardy native plants mixed in there that you obviously don't want to damage as you come in with your machinery, removing the predominant invasive species? Is that an issue? Or typically when you're seeing invasive species of this severity, is there very likely nothing in the way of native plants in the midst of them?
It depends on the site. You know, there are some sites where there's just nothing good there. But, you know, the case of Parkside, there was plenty of good native species there. It's kind of, you know, in areas where, and it also depended on the habitat type that the project was aiming for. So, for instance, one of the units, the scrub shrub area, was pretty thick with invasive brush, and, you know, not a lot of natives in there as far as woody species went, you know, occasional oak or something that we would flag out so that the person operating the machine would be able to see that very easily. Everyone that operates our machinery, though, is also trained in plant identification, so they're able to, you know, tell the difference between buckthorn and an oak tree or a maple, you know, as they're in the machinery. In the areas where there's more natives than invasives, or kind of a, you know, even split, you know, that's areas where we'd go with a little bit lighter footprint and be doing the hand removal as opposed to the machine removal. So
is this work that is being done every day? I mean, 5 days a week, and pretty much year round.
Mm-hmm. It is. I mean, today the crews are not out because we've got lightning and thunder and too much rain coming down, which is good right now. But, you know, in the winter, yeah, we're doing invasive brush removal all winter. Spring is, you know, prescribed burns and start of the growing season, start removing invasives, installing natives, all summer long. Same kind of thing, not necessarily burning so much in the summer, and then fall is another burn season. So yeah, it's, you know, all year round, 5 days a week, sometimes more if I can get the crew to work more.
Right. Can you explain that the business of prescribed burning? Are there particular settings or situations where that makes sense, and why does it make sense?
Well, that's kind of what I was talking about, you know, just the way nature functioned pre-settlement, and, you know, lightning could strike in a prairie, it would burn. So these native plants have co-evolved, you know, with burning. Many natives, you know, they germinate better and more effectively with fire going through while the invasive plants are not, you know, have not evolved alongside fire. So they do not tolerate fire as well. And it really knocks back a lot of the invasive species, but bolsters the natives. So, you know, we burn in a variety of different environments as far as, you know, I had talked about South Milwaukee schools. So sometimes we're burning around a school building. Sometimes we're burning out in the middle of nowhere, you know, so it's there's residential properties that have small prairies that, you know, have us come and do prescribed burning on their properties. So it's really, you know, as long as things are done in a safe manner and, you know, by trained professionals and, you know, you kind of look out for obstacles and things of that nature that you need to be aware of when burning, it's a good practice for almost any natural habitat. So.
Does it have to be done?
For every prescribed burn that you do, do you submit a burn plan to the local fire department?
Yeah, yep. Yeah, we have to do a burn plan, get all the necessary permits together. And then, you know, like I said, just, you know, having the crew trained and ready to do it. You know, some burns are very straightforward. Some of them get a little sketchy. You just got to, you know, kind of have your head on a pivot at all times, keeping your eyes on everything. And
I should think that in drought conditions, it has to be done with sort of extra care.
Yeah. If there's a restriction on burning, we don't burn. I mean, if it's dangerous, you know, the risks outweigh the benefits in a way, then yeah, burning just doesn't occur. So, and that's typically, you know, spring and fall are the wetter times of the year where we don't have drought conditions. So it's usually a better time. Plus there's a lot of, you know, dead plant material to burn. But yeah, if it's an unsafe condition, it doesn't happen. And we do, when before performing a burn, you know, there's a checklist that you go through and make sure that, you know, the wind is doing what it said it was going to do. And, you know, humidity is where it needs to be. And there's a lot of factors that go into making sure that it's going to be safe to perform the burn.
Excellent. So if we were to go to the places on the UW Parkside campus where you have been doing this work, how different would it look to the amateur eye compared to, you know, before all of this began? Does it look empty at a glance, or does it just look different?
I would say, you know, one of the units probably looks a little empty to the passerby, you know, and that's the shrub we were talking about that is getting turned to oak savanna. That was pretty choked up with woody invasive. So, you know, that was all cleared out with the exception of, you know, a few things here and there that were able to be held on to. But it's starting to really come back nicely with, you know, there's a lot of wild bergamot out there. It's a lot of natives coming up, and so, you know, it looks a little barren. It can be a little shocking at first when you see, you know, an area that there used to be all these, you know, to the amateur eye, trees and, you know, vegetation there. And, many people would think that those trees and plants are, you know, beneficial or okay to be there. But getting them out of there, it can be a little shocking. It does look like a little bit of a war zone at first. But that is with, you know, any type of cleanup, I guess. It always gets worse before it gets better in some way. So,
yeah, I think it's really important that you mentioned that, Deanna, because anytime you're working with a woodland, if you will, restoration, taking out large specimens of invasive trees and shrubs looks absolutely dreadful, mm-hmm. right after they've than mown with a forestry mower. Yep. And when people see it, they're thinking, my goodness, you know, they've broken the whole thing. How are they going to repair that? And I had the privilege of taking a group of people to look at that site. And there happened to be two little girls who were about 6 or 7 years old. And they just exclaimed very loudly, this is a disaster. But then, you know, I started pointing out things that were beginning to come back, like Minarda and a few other things, and getting people to understand, no, this is a good thing. You know, yeah. You have to break eggs before you make omelets. So these are our broken eggs, and we're going to come up with something really good. And hopefully they'll be coming back successive years so that they can see things improve greatly. And then for them to understand that, yes, even in this early stage, we had a rusty patched bumblebee come back. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a huge success for everybody. So just for all of our listening audience, just hang in there with us. It'll look great eventually.
Yeah, it is.
Gotta be patient.
You have to be patient.
Right. We just have a couple minutes, literally a couple of minutes left. But Deanna, can you say a quick word about the other part besides the removal of the invasives, the fostering of native plants? Do you just stand back and let them appear? Or do they need to really be introduced into this place? I mean, do they need to be planted the way we think of planting other things?
We, you know, at Parkside, for instance, we'll be doing some seeding following the burn, and then we'll be installing some native shrubs and some emergent plugs in phase two. You know, there's some areas where there's that really great seed bank that, you know, once you allow light and reduce the competition for nutrients and water from the invasives, you really see the natives just start to explode. But then there's other areas where maybe there isn't that seed bank there because it's been degraded for so long. And in those cases, you need to put some seed down, put some plant in, and then let nature do its work. So,
well, that's of course an exciting thing to think about in terms of what is going to be growing and flourishing and making these kind of environments so beautiful. Deanna Nicky is a restoration ecologist with RES. It's been great to meet you and to hear about the work that you and your colleagues do with Resource Environmental Solutions. I really appreciate you being part of the morning show.
Thank you for having me.
Great. Dan Calvert, before we go, I know you have a couple of quick announcements.
Very quickly. I would encourage people to, you know, while they're following along with us all on the restoration at UW Parkside, in the interim, I'd like you to go to Pritchard Park in Racine. That restoration is just a little bit over 3 years old now, and you'll see what that looks like. So the prairie and the pollinator swale, they're looking fantastic. And I can tell you that we have 2 confirmed sightings of rusty patched bumblebees within the restoration. And that just happened a couple of days ago. So really exciting. Again, I mean, this is amazing. And so in terms of announcements, I'd like to make sure everybody remembers that Hawthorne Hollow is having its Walk in the Woods Art Fair on September 11th from 10 in the morning until 4 p.m. All you need to do is go to the website. You can download all of the information about, you know, the artists and what they do, and then you can register right from the website. Also, their concert series is still going on, so check that out on their website as well. That's a really popular thing to do in the summer. Then the Eco Justice Center, of course, continues with its yoga with alpacas. The next date is August 21st. And then just be able to attend by registering from their website, ecojusticecenter.org. And one final announcement, Root Pike Watershed Initiative Network has begun its Watershed Warrior classes. Actually, those start this week. And the first class is Botany 101. That class is full, but we are taking registrations for a possible second class. Go to our website. There's a whole series of classes almost every month through spring of 2022. So we invite you all to register and become a watershed warrior.
Very good. The world needs more of that. Very good.
Yes, we do.
Robert, thank you so much. And once again, Deanna, Nikki, thank you for being part of the morning show today.
Thank you, Greg.